This is The Takeaway from Monday, May 1st, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. So who has the rights? States, cities, or the federal government? It's a legal battle raging all over the country right now. While states' rights were the linchpin of challenges to the Obama administration over Obamacare and other initiatives, states are still in play both against and in support of the Trump administration. But cities are also targets right now. Here's Attorney General Jeff Sessions outlining a policy back in March that cities in particular cannot expect to maintain a so-called sanctuary policy regarding immigration.
I'm urging states and local jurisdictions to comply with these federal laws, including 8 U.S.C. Section 1373. Moreover, the Department of Justice will require that jurisdictions seeking or applying for Department of Justice grants to certify compliance with 1373 as a condition of receiving those awards.
But U.S. District Judge William Orrick ruled last week that President Trump had exceeded his presidential authority when he signed an executive order on January 25th that ordered federal funding to be withheld from the more than 300 cities that qualify as sanctuary jurisdictions. Leon Fresco, former Deputy Attorney General of the Justice Department, where he was head of the Office of Immigration Litigation under the Obama administration, says the idea that the federal government would punish the cities is key to Judge Orrick's decision.
The issue is that generally, over the course of many decades, there has been legislation that has said that if certain states and localities don't do certain programs, they don't get certain federal funding. But during the Obamacare legislation implementation, there was a piece of legislation which said that if states do not accept what's called the Medicaid expansion, which would have expanded Medicaid for populations that didn't have insurance, they would have lost all of their Medicaid funding. And so the Supreme Court said that that kind of level of a decrease of funding was deemed coercive and was deemed to violate the 10th Amendment. And so what Judge Orrick said was that, again, if there was a threat that a state or a city would lose all of its federal funding, not just a small targeted portion of federal funding for, quote unquote, refusing to enforce the immigration law, which was, again, not clear what that meant, that would be an unconstitutional program that would be implemented toward the states and the cities.
What evidence did Judge Orrick cite that the administration is using this as a kind of punitive measure?
Well, so here's what's interesting. Because this threat had not been implemented into law and had just been remaining a threat, what Judge Orrick said was he needed to go into the statements that were actually being made by the president and by the attorney general. And the statements there were very clear, but very broad. They said that if a state and locality refused to enforce the immigration law, that state and locality would lose all of its federal funding. And so even though the Department of Justice was arguing, no, it would be a very small, targeted two or three grants programs that would not affect the states and localities in any kind of substantive manner, the judge said, well, you cannot reconcile that with the statements actually being made by the attorney general and the president. And because the cities need budgeting certainty, they need to know what grants are coming and not coming, he felt it was appropriate to rule immediately and to enjoin any threat or possibility that the city of San Francisco and Santa Clara might lose their federal funding because they were not, quote unquote, cooperating with the immigration law, which again was not clear what cooperation would be expected prior to losing the funding.
Now, is there an issue that if the federal government tries to mess with money that's allocated to the states, it also runs into the congressional power to, you know, lay and collect taxes and to, you know, control fiscal spending?
Right. Correct. Which is, you're correct, John, which is to say that one of the other things that troubled Judge Orrick in this case was that Judge Orrick said, if you're going to do something like cut all federal funding, then That is something that needs to be done by Congress. Congress needs to say, if you don't do X, Y, and Z with regard to immigration enforcement, here are the levels of funding that you lose. Now, again, the Attorney General was saying it'd be all federal funding. The president was saying it was all federal funding. But in the court, the Department of Justice was saying, no, it's these two or three targeted grant programs that already have this in there. But the judge said that's not what the Attorney General and the president were saying, so I'm going to enjoin any threat on this sort of broad federal funding laws for failure to enforce the immigration laws.
Leon Fresco is former Deputy Assistant Attorney General at the Justice Department, where he was head of the Office of Immigration Litigation under the Obama administration. Leon, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
San Francisco is in the district of federal Judge Orrick, and it's hardly surprising that San Francisco would be one of the plaintiffs, along with Santa Clara down the bay, in this sanctuary city's case that has delivered a legal setback to the president. Marisa Lagos from her station KQED in San Francisco says in this report there's a long history and lots of civic pride over San Francisco's sanctuary city identity.
The debate began in the 1980s as civil wars raged in Central America and churches began providing refuge to fleeing immigrants.
They were seeking asylum because they would, had they stayed, they would have been killed.
Tom Amiano has been involved in San Francisco politics for 5 decades and represented the city in the state assembly. He says in the 80s, the Reagan administration refused to give Central American immigrants asylum, so cities began stepping up. First Berkeley, then dozens of others, including San Francisco, adopted policies prohibiting local officials from cooperating with immigration enforcement. San Francisco Sheriff Vicki Hennessy was working as a deputy in the jail back then.
Up until that time, ICE agents, or at the time immigration agents, were allowed to come into our jails and check all the booking cards and see who and question anybody they wanted to question.
The city's early sanctuary policies stopped those visits. But in 1989, they didn't stop immigration officials and San Francisco police from conducting a joint raid on a Latino dance club in San Francisco, Club Elegante. Dozens of people were handcuffed and detained for hours, including many U.S. citizens.
It was obvious that this was a big snafu that should have never happened.
Tom Amiano says that the raid
was what ignited that sleeping giant. And then there were demands made on the mayor. And, well, what are you going to do? What is a solution?
Civil rights attorney Robert Rubin helped write what would become San Francisco's sanctuary city law later that year and says even the city's conservative police chief was on board.
It wasn't even so much that he loved immigrants. It was, I think, more a sense of we need this type of policy because without it, we lose the trust and cooperation of the immigrant community that we're devoted to serve.
Rubin and others working in the city at the time say the federal government pushed back against these policies, even threatening to jail city leaders or strip federal funding. But as time passed, the city's law remained. So did outside pressure to change it. And in June 2008, the slaying of a San Francisco man and his two sons shook San Francisco to the core.
Cops say Edwin Ramos, shown here, is the killer, a suspected MS-13 gang member here illegally from El Salvador.
Danielle Bologna lost her husband, Tony, and 2 of her 4 kids in a heart-wrenching case of mistaken identity. Within weeks, conservative pundits came calling. Here's Danielle Bologna on the talk show of conservative commentator Laura Ingraham a month after the murders.
This should happen to any family. Any family should not have to go through what I'm going through right now. I can't even tell you guys. We were such a close family. We did everything. We did everything right. But yet these immigrants have more rights than we do.
The San Francisco Chronicle reported that the accused shooter, Edwin Ramos, was convicted of 2 violent felonies as a juvenile, but wasn't deported because of the city's policy not to hand over minors to Immigration and Customs Enforcement in any circumstance. San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom defended the sanctuary policy, but also rushed to change how the city handled juvenile offenders. Under the changes, any undocumented kid merely accused of a felony was given to immigration officials, even though adult suspects were still protected. Over the next year, the city turned over more than 100 juveniles to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. A year later, the Board of Supervisors amended city law to clarify that only juveniles convicted of a felony should be reported to ICE. But in those early months, says Tom Amiano, a key fact was lost in the flurry of outrage.
It was the feds who dropped the ball.
Bologna family friend Marnie McKee agrees and says ICE knew exactly who and where the Bologna shooter was because he was the subject of a federal gang investigation and he'd applied for legal status.
They were communicating with him because he was trying to get his status changed. They knew where he worked. They knew where he lived. They knew where he hung out. They knew where he committed criminal activities. They were following him around.
Again in 2015, a horrific murder roiled San Francisco and made national headlines.
San Francisco police have 45-year-old Francisco Sanchez in custody. CRON4 sources say that Sanchez is on probation in Texas and in the country illegally. Those sources also say that Sanchez has been deported to Mexico several times.
32-year-old Kate Steinle was shot and killed while walking along the San Francisco waterfront. But again, there was blame to go around. Sanchez had recently been released from San Francisco jail after a court dismissed a 20-year-old marijuana charge. Then Sheriff Ross Mercurimi ignored orders to tell immigration officials about his release, citing the sanctuary law. But why he was in San Francisco in the first place remains unclear. Sanchez had just finished almost 4 years in a federal prison for crossing the border illegally, the fifth time he'd been caught sneaking into the U.S. He also had 7 felony convictions. Yet the federal government transferred him to San Francisco for a decades-old misdemeanor instead of deporting him again. And while the policies remain unpopular among conservatives outside San Francisco's borders, a recent poll found that 79% of San Franciscans approve of the sanctuary law. City leaders have taken note. Most of the 10 tweaks to the law made since 1989 have made it harder for local officials to cooperate with ICE. Now, state lawmakers are considering a bill that could make California a sanctuary state in the view of the Trump administration by limiting state and local police from cooperating with most deportation actions. Senate President Kevin DeLeon, a Los Angeles Democrat, says the bill will keep communities safe.
The last thing we need is for crime to increase in neighborhoods because police officers have left their beat, their duties to go and help set up a perimeter around a church or a shelter or an elementary school. Local police departments protect and serve. They don't enforce federal immigration law.
Sheriffs and others are fighting the bill. But De Leon and supporters of sanctuary laws say it's important to note what sanctuary laws don't do. For example, they don't prevent local jails from sharing fingerprints with ICE. Every county in the nation does that. And says Robert Rubin, the author of San Francisco's original law,
people needed to understand that nothing in the City Refuge Ordinance could do anything to stop the federal government from enforcing its own immigration laws. It simply said, we're not going to help you. We're not going to be a part of it. We think that this is the wrong way to go.
It's not entirely clear what the fiscal consequences for California or San Francisco may be, though the city didn't wait to find out, suing the president days after his executive order was issued in January. San Francisco receives about $2 billion a year from the federal government. But a lawyer for the Trump administration said in court recently that the administration isn't going after all that money, just law enforcement grants. The judge in that case made clear he believes it would be illegal for the administration to go any further. Judge William Orrick also said he thinks the cities have a strong case that Trump's broader funding threat is unconstitutional. State Senator Kevin DeLeon agrees.
You just can't, with a signature, you know, with a pen, say, I'm going to punish San Francisco, Los Angeles, or any other city. The reality is this. It's illegal and it's unconstitutional.
It will be up to the courts to decide who's right. For The Takeaway, I'm Marisa Lagos in San Francisco.
Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson loves his job. He was a high school chess champion who's taken his skills and translated them into courtroom tactics and fearless aggression. That's a chess term. Ferguson is now a fierce defender of consumers in his state. He took President Obama into court over safety conditions for nuclear workers, successfully challenged the Trump immigration travel ban, and is hard at work trying to protect students from the Wild West gold rush in the student loan business right now.
This is a massive problem, not just for my state, but nationwide. We've had lots of litigation against loan adjusters, for example. These are entities that ostensibly say they're going to help you consolidate your loan, that type of thing, that charge fees they're not allowed to charge, that overcharge fees, even though they are allowed to charge them, they overcharge them. So we see this frankly, John, over and over and over again, to the point where I've got folks in my Consumer Protection Division who, frankly, dedicate much of their time to being an advocate on these issues of student loans.
Can you change this from the standpoint of, litigating a solution, or does something have to happen in Washington, D.C.? Does some lawmaker really have to take this up?
It's a good question. From my view, it's going to require a combination of things to make a change. One is, hey, giving more information to students, for example. We put out in my office recently a student loan guidance handbook that's available on our website for students or graduates to review so they know what their rights are and have some information about the loans they're taking out. So more information, I think, for students at the front end can make a big help, number one. Number two, yes, litigation is appropriate to serve as a deterrent for those entities that don't play by the rules. That's important. But third, to your point, yes, do I think we need more advocates at the federal level on these issues? I do. And to make sure that there are common sense protections for borrowers when they interact with servicers like Navient.
Attorneys general around the country have, been recognized as being politically savvy and that the attorney general position is a springboard to higher political office. I'm wondering if you look at consumer protection issues and, for instance, the travel ban question as political opportunities or ways of protecting voters. And how do you choose?
Well, the way we choose in my office and is that we go where the law takes us. So, hey, a lot of folks I've been criticized for filing the lawsuit that stopped the first travel ban as being political. I'm a Democrat, Donald Trump obviously being a Republican. But what folks don't mention when they assert that is I twice filed lawsuits against the Obama administration, even though I deeply respect and admire former President Barack Obama. We go where the law takes us. So I get that folks want to make it all about politics. But as I say, John, if someone's arguing that, that just means they don't really have a legal argument. So from our standpoint, our role is to protect the people of my state against powerful interests that don't play by the rules. Sometimes it's a president. Sometimes that's an entity like Navient. Sometimes it's not in the news at all. But that is very important work for every attorney general in the country.
Implicitly in what you just said, does that mean you don't respect and honor President Donald Trump?
No, it's he and I have a very different worldview, to put it mildly. Let's put it that way. And but my point is, I'm not filing a lawsuit against Donald Trump successfully over the travel ban because I disagree with him as an elected official or disagree with him on policy issues. I have deep disagreements with him. But I filed a lawsuit because I felt his travel ban was unconstitutional and unlawful. That's why we filed that lawsuit, and frankly, that's why we won. So that's the analysis. If you'd been in the room when I made my decision to file that lawsuit with my Solicitor General, look, none of the conversation was about anything political. It was all about the Constitution, whether I could bring that lawsuit, whether we thought we'd be successful. Those were the questions I was asking and that we're focused on.
From a very different political perspective, the state of Arizona went after the Obama administration because immigration policy is sort of stuck in a kind of limbo, and they viewed their state interests as being fundamentally different from the federal interests. You, I think, have done something similar from a completely different point of view in confronting the federal government on the travel ban. Do you think attorneys general are closer to the kinds of issues that aren't being addressed by the federal government?
It's an important question, and I think a part of the answer is yes. A lot has been written in the last, I guess I'd say, 8 or 9 years of the role of the attorney general. And when I ran for attorney general for the first time 5 years ago, John, I would often say when I was running that I felt the office of attorney general was the most consequential office in all of government. And people always gave me a strange look when I said that. When I say that now, in light of stopping the travel ban, nobody gives me a funny look. I think there's a greater appreciation for the power of the office of the attorney general to make sure that everybody's playing by the rules. And I think there is a greater focus now. We see that with airlines, with consumer protections at airlines, or with Wall Street interests, or even the President of the United States. There is a greater focus, I think, on the rights of consumers and individuals and the power of the law to change practices. And that's where, of course, an attorney general comes in.
You haven't been recognized as a chess player for a while, but do you think if they included your success on the travel ban in court, that your stress rating might have gone up significantly, that you won that battle, and you know, your numbers might have bumped up to, say, close to 2,000.
Yeah, you know, my chess playing days are largely over, and you know, I did spend a lot of my teenage years playing chess seriously. After high school, I did not go to college right away, John, and went to Europe and tried to play chess professionally. So chess really has informed my worldview and the way I think about things. And for the travel ban, I will say we anticipated that Donald Trump would sign that executive order. We anticipated that move, so to speak, to use a chess term. And so the team was ready, and I think it's part of the reason why we moved so quickly and were able to get it struck down on an injunction so quickly as well. We prepared for that, and we're ready to go.
You dropped out of college. You decided not to go to college and do chess as an alternative to college. Which one of your parents convinced you to maybe come back and join the human race?
I have to say my parents were both a bit concerned when I told them I was not going to go to college and was going to go to Europe and play chess, as you might imagine. So I think they were equally concerned. I think my father, my late father, Murray Ferguson, took the most active role in trying to push me back to the University of Washington, and he ultimately succeeded. So I'm not sure if, you know, I recognize that being a former chess professional is not the usual path to being attorney general, but it did work for me.
Well, we're glad that your father was successful, that's for sure. Bob Ferguson, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, John. Really appreciate it.
Bob Ferguson is the 18th Attorney General of the state of Washington. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. It's May Day, also known as International Workers' Day, commemorating the 1886 Haymarket Affair, when nearly a quarter of a million workers nationwide went on strike, demanding an eight-hour workday. Historically, it became a day to march in favor of workers' rights, and immigrant rights are also part of today's celebration, as nationwide marches are planned in resistance to the Trump administration's policies. Peter Linebaugh is a historian and author of The Incomplete, True, Authentic, and Wonderful History of May Day. Peter Linebaugh, welcome to The Takeaway.
Happy May Day.
Happy May Day, in fact. And spending a lot of time out of the United States, it's surprising how vividly and intensely the celebration of May Day as a labor holiday is contrasted with the absence of the holiday entirely in the United States and our own Labor Day way up in September.
Yes, deliberately so. They moved May Day to Labor Day just to divide us from the rest of the world, the workers of the rest of the world. But whether we like it or not, the rest of the world is coming to the USA and reminding us of our own history.
And the history of Labor Day really begins with something that happened on May 4th in 1886. Remind us.
Yes, that's the Haymarket bombing up the Haymarket Square in Chicago. 4 days earlier, as part of the eight-hour day movement, four iron workers were killed. And a demonstration and protest was held at Haymarket in outrage at that police murder. But at Haymarket itself, a bomb was thrown, and to this day, no one knows who did it. As a result, seven people were tried for murder, and four were hanged. They're known as the martyrs throughout Mexico, for instance. Albert Parsons, George Engel, Adolf Fischer, and August Spies.
So these American martyrs, who, by the way, I believe were also immigrants on some level, are recognized throughout the world as labor heroes.
Yes, they are, because they were advocating the eight-hour day. The slogan was 8 hours work, 8 hours rest, and 8 hours for what you will. And you're quite right to say they were immigrants. In fact, workers are generally immigrants. Certainly, that's been the history of our own country, dating back to the first May Day in 1627, which was immigrants from the British Isles. It was more in the pagan tradition, going back to Neolithic times and a celebration of the spring, a celebration of life, a celebration of fertility. In fact, really, the two things become connected. The eight-hour movement was related to this traditional May Day as a festival of life.
And the eight-hour workday didn't make it as a result of the Haymarket riot, but it did gain traction around the world and eventually did make it to the United States. Is that the case?
Well, it used to be the case, but I think for quite a number of years now, the 8 hours is no longer the statutory, legal, or actual working day. And most of us find ourselves working much more than that, also on weekends, and also with this technology of electronics, we even work in the car.
What's the chance, given the profile of May Day around the world, that Donald Trump could change the brand of the day into something called Loyalty Day?
Well, Pennsylvania tried to do that in 1949, changed the day to Americanism Day, but it didn't stick. May Day's always been it's been a holiday, and I think that runs up against the puritanical work discipline, which has been a big part of American life. What we need to do really is to take it easy and to enjoy life, and that's what May Day is about. Not about consumerism, but about the two best things in life, which is love of each other and love of nature.
Peter Linebaugh is a historian and author of The Incomplete, True, Authentic, and Wonderful History of May Day. Peter, thanks so much.
You're very welcome, John.
So does this American idea of Loyalty Day on May 1st have any credibility? Well, it's got Donald Trump behind it and an act of Congress.
The 20th annual Loyalty Day Parade on Fifth Avenue, sponsored by the Veterans of Foreign Wars. Close to 6,000 similar marches took place simultaneously across the nation.
That's from the 20-year commemoration of Loyalty Day back in 1967. Nicole Hammer, assistant professor in presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center, says Loyalty Day has a history that tracks roughly parallel to the original Workers' May Day.
When it first got started in 1917, 1918, it actually happened on July 4th, and it was about immigrants who'd come to the United States and trying to Americanize them. So trying to get them to not identify as Polish American or German American, but part of this anti-immigrant sentiment in the 19-teens. When you get to 1921, you're in the middle of the first Red Scare after the Russian Revolution. That's when Loyalty Day gets moved to May 1st.
Because May 1st had a real association with socialist movement, the anarchist movement, and the communist movement around the world.
That's right. So it was a bit of counter-programming. And when it gets revived in 1947, it is explicitly put on May 1st for that reason, as an alternative to this socialist or communist May Day celebration.
Are people widely aware of Loyalty Day on May 1st?
So as far as I can tell, no, because the reaction to the news that Donald Trump was declaring May 1st Loyalty Day was pretty shocked and surprised. So I think it's one of those holidays on the calendar that the only people who really notice are the presidential writing staff who have to draw up a proclamation every year. But now that it's kind of been associated with Donald Trump, everyone is talking about it.
So whatever, you know, angst is drawn up here or is stirred up here on May 1st, the profile of Donald Trump may actually cause Loyalty Day to stick finally and not be like, you know, National Donut Day.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting because, you know, what we've seen so far is largely a backlash to the day. I mean, it does have less than savory roots and people are a little concerned about, you know, the idea of Donald Trump and Loyalty Day. But it is quite possible that people could now know this holiday and remember this holiday and actually talk about it and what it means.
Is there a concern about loyalty in America that really goes back to the founders, that as great as the ideas are of America, that there would be a lot of people who have no sympathy and want nothing to do with the success of the country?
Well, I think that it pops up now and again, especially in times of intense anxiety, whether it's times of war. You can understand, you know, the anxiety about German Americans and Italian Americans during World War I, but also during times of economic anxiety, this idea that people are going to doubt the values that underlie the United States in a time when the United States isn't actually providing much for them. And so those anxieties burble up. But by and large, we haven't seen subversive movements in the United States other than the South during the Civil War. So I think that there's been a lot of concern about loyalty, but there hasn't actually been a lot to fear.
And it didn't occur to Lincoln to come up with a Loyalty Day, although he might have had reason to.
That's right. Loyalty Day probably would have been an interesting idea back in 1861.
Nicole Hammer, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Nicole Hammer is assistant professor in presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. But in a global competition over what this day means, it's likely that May Day, the traditional workers' holiday, would win hands down. Here are some votes from Pakistan, Brisbane, Australia, and right here in the U.S. outside of Trump Tower. Workers of the world, the U.S. is not united in your Workers' Day celebration. That's right. In the USA, May 1 is Loyalty Day, first observed in 1921, called Americanization Day then, to counter International Workers' Day, promoted by socialists and communists to honor workers on May 1. In 1955, Congress recognized it as a special day, as did President Eisenhower. And 3 years later, legislators passed a law making it an annual holiday, and since then, every president has issued a proclamation to mark Loyalty Day.
The Takeaway is supported by Constant Contact, offering email marketing features like drag-and-drop editing and mobile-friendly templates. Constant Contact's products are focused on helping small businesses. More at ConstantContact.com.
Conspiracy theories, the original fake news. Was there a woman pope? Are alien bodies frozen at a secret facility in Roswell, New Mexico? Moon landing happened on a soundstage in Los Angeles, not at Tranquility Base, right? If you answered yes to any of those questions, you're like a lot of Americans. This week, our friends at Retro Report remind us of the power of conspiracy theories in the mother of all news events, the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Jennifer Oko is a freelance producer and co-produced this week's Retro Report with Miriam Weintraub.
The whole media landscape is pretty much trafficking in conspiracy theories, right and left. And it's really hard between that and fake news to figure out what's actually happening in the world and what should we believe. Joseph Uzinski talks about this in our piece, that conspiracy theory and conspiracy thinking goes back to the founding of our country.
You can go back a couple hundred years and then you'll see, oh, we're afraid of the redcoats. And in the 1990s, they're afraid of the black helicopters. There's always someone coming for us.
Part of the way that our brains are structured is that we look for narratives that we make out of facts. We find little facts here and there. And we put them together in such a way that makes sense to us, that helps us understand the world. And that may or may not lead us to the truth.
The idea that Americans are or were or variously are trapped in a bubble of conspiracy or mythology regarding the Kennedy assassination is evident from the CBS Dan Rather investigation that polls the American people.
The CBS News nationwide poll last month indicated that in President Kennedy's case, 68% believe that Oswald was involved with others in the crime. I remind you that the official version is Oswald alone was solely responsible. Only 15% believe that.
The numbers are absolutely amazing.
Yeah. There are different polls depending on which ones you look at, but generally speaking, the majority of Americans still believe there was a cover-up.
Alexandra Zapruder is the granddaughter of Abraham Zapruder, who shot that home film. It was a Super 8, 8mm film of the JFK assassination. What is her view of all this? Because she's close to something tangible. She's not dreaming.
She's not. And actually, she's been in her whole life, willingly or not, dealing with conspiracy theory.
The Warren Commission said that the president was hit in the rear of the head. That basic conflict led people to assume that there was a second shooter, evidence of a conspiracy that has been covered up by the government.
I didn't know much about the Kennedy assassination beyond, you know, school book learning before I did this. And I just found it so fascinating how little they revealed, how disappointing the Warren Report really felt. And then even since then, how it still feels fishy. I mean, there very well may not have been a conspiracy and there very well may not have been anyone but Lee Harvey Oswald. But they're acting in such weird ways that it's very hard to feel completely comfortable with whatever it is that the government says.
And the federal government will help when it behaves in such a way. As Robert Goldberg said, if you were looking for evidence of conspiracy or bizarre behaving government, you were going to find it in that era.
Americans do not trust their leaders. I think that Americans do not trust the basic institutions that govern us, whether they're corporations, universities, the judiciary.
The height of the trust in the federal government sort of peaked right before the release of the Warren Commission's report.
Oh, that's so interesting.
And it was soon after. Yeah, I mean, and it's right when you look at it, it's right after that, like about a month after that, it starts to slide. And then it starts to slide really fast. And then you've got all sorts of things. You've got Vietnam, you got Watergate, you got all sorts of things that compound that. So you can't say that the Kennedy assassination is what spurned this complete lack of faith in the government that we have today. But it was certainly a catalyst.
What do you think people's reaction to your piece will be? Will they say, well, she avoided the big deal, that obviously she's part of the conspiracy, she's covering it up? Or or will they view this media story, this media narrative, as, you know, something that helps put everything in context?
I hope people come out of this piece and sort of see what I learned, which was when you combine a growing distrust in the federal government and a feeling like the government isn't revealing things to us, and you combine that with this media environment that we have today, we're in some really uncharted territory, and it's quite scary to me, and I'm not really sure what the answer is, but I think understanding what's going on and trying to parse that out will hopefully help us find that answer.
Jennifer Oko is a freelance producer who co-produced Conspiracy's Grip, part of our Retro Report. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we might get some answers soon on the Kennedy assassination. Later this year, the National Archives are due to release 3,600 files related to the assassination, most of which come from the CIA and FBI. President Trump can decide whether to block their release, a decision he hasn't made, at least not publicly, yet.
This is Catherine in Dallas, Texas. The conspiracy theory I believe in? Well, I believe that aliens walk among us. My proof? My ex-in-laws, because they cannot possibly be of this world.
Well, thank you, Catherine. Aliens, Area 51, JFK, what conspiracy theories do you believe in?
Tecoria Jones, Columbia, South Carolina. I believe in aliens because human beings cannot be the most advanced species in the universe.
Aloha, this is Ian from Maui. And the conspiracy theory I believe in is 9/11 was an inside job. And the reason for this is physics. You don't hit a building at the top and have the whole thing come down like a controlled explosion. And also, what about Tower 7? Nothing even got close to that.
New York, New York. I think the British royal family was complicit somehow in the death of Princess Diana. Some of the facts of that night's events were never revealed, and the only surviving witness was, surprisingly, Mum, pun intended, afterward.
Hi, this is Eric in Chicago, and I believe in the conspiracy theory syllogism. So this is just a bit of classical logic and a little bit of common sense. Premise one, people sometimes plan things in secret. Premise two, sometimes people's plans are successful. So that would lead to the conclusion that sometimes a conspiracy theory will be true.
Anoka, Minnesota says the Roswell crash in Area 51, probability convinces me. Franklin, Florida says none. Show me the facts. Keep the conspiracies coming. 877-8-MY-TAKE, that's our number, and there's much more at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by LegalZoom.com, helping small business owners get started with incorporation, LLCs, DBAs, and nonprofits, while providing ongoing legal advice through its network of independent attorneys. More information available at LegalZoom.com/takeaway. And by Staples, offering copy and print solutions for business materials printed in-store or ordered online, including business cards, presentations, large banners, and posters. More at Staples and Staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
This next conversation about race in America takes us into the disheartening realization that race discrimination passes from generation to generation, and that people jump to all kinds of conclusions based on even seemingly slight differences in skin tone and hair. Adriana Rodriguez is a 17-year-old student at Food and Finance High School in Manhattan. She talks with her aunt, Nancy Lopez, about what it means to be a Dominican in the USA. The conversation takes us into their very Dominican family album.
When people go there, they don't know me. They think I'm from Guyana or Trinidad. They got no idea. I don't know. My faces look for a different nationality. But I don't know why they think that, because they think that I'm from Guyana, where I got curly hair. You know, I'm from Dominican.
Right.
We got, so like 80% of Dominican girls, they got curly hair.
Yeah. So describe your skin color. Like, is it like...
Let's say that I'm like brown sugar.
Brown sugar. Not like caramel mocha, but no, I'm brown sugar.
I'm a brown sugar.
Brown sugar. I remember sometimes some lady that she said that they thought that you were Indian because of your ring.
Oh, yeah.
Your nose ring.
One lady, she was there for the first time. She was known in this country from, I think she was from Colombia. I went to her and I said, "May I help you, lady?" She was like, "Oh, I don't understand these ladies." And then when I say in Spanish, you need my help. And she said, "Oh my God." And I was thinking, how I'm gonna understand that Indian lady.
Do you have customers that don't know that you're Hispanic?
Some customer.
You don't bother anything?
No, I don't bother. I said, well, let them think that I'm from there. Not a long time ago, there was an old man that he was there from, and he's from Trinidad. He was talking to me like, "I want other ladies." She said, "Oh my God, well, this and that." And I said, "I'm Spanish." He said, "You're Spanish? No, but you look just like my aunt." And I say, "What?" He said, "Yeah, same face and this and that." So I don't know why. And I said, "No, I'm Spanish. I'm from Dominican Republic." He said, "You don't look Dominican."
It's funny when people are like, "You don't look Dominican," because you can kind of think how a Dominican would look like, but there's really no saying, because we have, like, different skin tones. Like, even within our family, like, we have different skin tones. Like Adrian, he's lighter than me, and I'm darker than him. And also, like, the hair. Muñeca's daughter, her hair is, like, kind of, like, almost like a white people hair, but she's still Dominican. Have you ever been on the train and you see someone, like, dark skin, and you think that they're, like, African-American, and comes out of nowhere that they're actually Dominican?
Ooh, that happened all the time. I used to work in Jersey in one of the toys factory, and there was one a lady, and I thought she was African American. So we were talking about her, this and that. And then when we finished saying everything about her, she said, "Oh, thank you. I'm from Dominican too." My face was so red.
So, you know, my cousin, she's kind of like a light skin tone, like kind of like white, and she has blonde hair. And everybody in the family, como que, like, they praise her because ella es la rubia de la familia, whatever. Do you think that in Dominican families, if you're, like, lighter than that, like, they, it's common that to, like, praise a girl because that she's, like, she looks like a white girl?
I don't think so. I don't think that's in all the family. Some of the family, they like that. You know, like you say, your cousin, they think she's different because she looked that way. She looks different than all the cousins and this and that, or nephews or nieces. But I don't think it's like that, because in Dominican, we got all kind of people.
When you were in school, was it like that you had just different people that looked different?
Yeah, when I was at school, everybody was different. Different color, different skin color. Different color hair. I remember in the class there was one girl, the name is Julissa. She was light skin and green eyes and nice curly hair. She was so pretty. But nobody treat her different. Everybody was the same.
I remember when I wasn't, because you went to school in the Dominican Republic, and when I did fifth grade over there, there was this one girl, and her hair was straight. And she was, like, really light skin. Like, she was an alien, basically, to them. They were like, "Oh, my God, she's so pretty." And I'm just here, like, in the fifth grade, como una barrilito. And everybody was just like, "Ugh." I hated it over in school over there, because the teachers, as soon as they saw my birth certificate, they were making a big deal. It's like, "Oh, an American birth certificate. Oh, my God." They were calling out people to look at my birth. I'm like,
she's a gringuita.
Yeah. I was like, "Sis, calm down." And, oh, my God. And the kids, they used to hate me because of that, because I knew English. They used to hate me so much. Like, I remember I used to sit alone eating,
Don't tell me, platanos.
Nah. I'll be sitting alone eating my lunch. You know what happens to me is that a lot of people would say that I don't act Dominican that much. Because you know how Dominicans act. Because me, I don't eat avocado. So when I tell people that I don't eat avocados, they're like, "You're not Dominican." When I tell people that I've never eaten a chimichurri, they're like, "You're not Dominican." And there's a school, because in my school is like a campus. So there's like six other schools in there. And one of the schools is the majority are Dominicans. So I had some friends from that school, and they used to call me gringa because I don't act Dominican. When you tell people that you're from Dominican, when they think that you're from somewhere else, do they say that, oh, you don't act Dominican?
Oh, they always told me that. They say, oh, you don't talk like Dominican. And I say, why? Oh, because you don't talk with the way they say.
Yeah,
they say, oh, poique, or, you know. And I say, I don't know. I don't like to talk that way. Especially people from the north side of my country, they say that, like poique or no porque. And they say, oh, you don't look Dominican and you don't talk like Dominican people. I say, yes, I'm from the north of the country, and people, like, they talk like that, but not everybody.
Yeah.
But I know people that they go to college and this like that, and they still talk that way. I don't know why, but I don't like to talk that way.
Yeah, that's it. Like, it's not that we're, like, Americanized. It's not that we're just used to this culture. It's just the way that we are, because everybody's different. Even though they may be from the same race, everybody's different.
Right? Yeah, everybody's different. That's the way I grew up. They teach me how to say, you know, the way it is. I went to school, and that's what I followed. I don't change it.
That's Adriana Rodriguez, a high school student from the Bronx and co-host of the podcast Feeling Some Type of Way. She talked with her Aunt Nancy Lopez, a laundromat owner in Richmond Hills, Queens. Special thanks to Caitlin Pierce of WNYC's Radio Rookies for her help with this. If you want to take part in our Uncomfortable Truths series, head to thetakeaway.org/truths. Tell us who you'd like to have a conversation about race with. Could be a family member, a friend, or a coworker. Be a part of any of our conversations. We rely on your thoughts and ideas here at The Takeaway. Give us yours at 877-8-MY-TAKES. That is a tweet at The Takeaway. Find us on Facebook. And we want to give a hearty welcome to the listeners of WUNC. They begin carrying The Takeaway today. We're so happy to have you with us, and we look forward to your listeners calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'll be on the road this week traveling to KQED in San Francisco, one of the big voices of public radio on the West Coast. I'll be joining you from there later this week. Until then, thanks so much for listening on this May 1st. Whether you're celebrating May Day, International Workers' Day, or Loyalty Day, just get out of the controversy altogether and rip your shirt off and dance around a maypole, I say. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.